maybe because I forced him to keep on living. He appeals directly to me.
The wonders they had to offer. Can't you understand? I thought I was ushering in a golden age for humanity. How could I say no to them? To him?
And now you have to keep taking this stuff. Is that it? I ask, glancing to the syringes that I bet contain something like the unnatural genetic brew the Moogs use to grow their disposable soldiers. If you stop, you'll break down like one of them.
Old enough to turn to dust, anyway,
Nine grumbles.
It's been 2 days, and look at me.
Sanderson waves a hand at himself, at his body that looks like a slug with salt poured on it.
They used me, kept giving me treatments in exchange for favors, but you freed me. Now I can finally die.
Nine throws up his hands and looks at me.
Dude, screw this! This guy's a lost cause. We need to figure something else out.
A sense of desperation begins to sink in now that Walker's lead on the Secretary of Defense has turned up only a broken old man and gotten us no closer to thwarting the imminent Mogadorian invasion. But I'm not willing to give up just yet. This lump sitting in front of me used to be a powerful man. Hell, the Moogs had a protection detail on him. So, he still is. There has to be a way to fix him, to make him willing to fight. I need him to see the light. Some combination of desperation and intuition causes me to turn on my lumen. I don't crank it up to fire level. Instead, I produce just enough juice so that a beam of pure light shoots from my hand. Sanderson's eyes widen, and he inches back on the bed away from me. I already told you. I'm not going to hurt you, I say as I lean in towards him. I shine my lumen on the palsied, saggy part of his face, wanting to get a good look at what I'm dealing with. The skin is grayed and almost dead-looking, fine, ash-colored veins running through it. The dark particles under Sanderson's skin actually seem to float away from my lumen, almost like they're trying to burrow deeper. I can heal this, I say resolutely. I'm not sure if it's actually true, but I have to try.
You can fix what they did?
Sanderson asks, a note of hope in his gravelly voice. I can make you like you were, I reply. Not better, in the way they promised, not younger, just as you should be.
Old people get old, Nine puts in. You gotta deal with it.
Sanderson looks at me skeptically. I must sound just like the Mogadorians did years ago, when they first convinced him to join their side.
What do you want in exchange?
He asks, like a high price is a foregone conclusion. Nothing, I reply. You can try killing yourself again for all I care. Or maybe you can find what's left of your conscience and do what's right. It'll be up to you. And with that, I press my palm against the side of Sanderson's face. Sanderson shudders as the warm, healing energy of my legacy passes into him. Normally, when using my healing powers, I get a sensation that the injury is knitting itself back together, of cells rearranging themselves beneath my fingertips. With Sanderson, it feels as if a force is pushing back against my legacy, as if there are dark, cellular pits into which my healing light plunges down and gutters out. I still feel Sanderson healing, but it's slow going, and I have to concentrate much harder than usual. At one point, something actually sizzles and pops beneath his skin. One of his discolored veins burning up. Sanderson flinches away from me. Are you hurt? I ask, short of breath. my hands still poised next to his face. He hesitates.
No. No. It actually feels better. Somehow cleaner. Keep going.
I keep going. I can feel the Mogadorian sludge burrowing deeper into Sanderson, retreating from my legacy. I intensify my healing, chasing it through his veins. I find that I'm squinting from the exertion, and a cold sweat dampens my back. I'm so focused on beating back the darkness, I detect inside Sanderson that I must lose track of time or enter some kind of trance state. When I'm finished at last, I stumble backwards, my legs wobbly, and run right into Sam. I wasn't even aware he'd come upstairs. He's holding out a phone. Did he steal it from that bystander we knocked over? And recording my healing of Sanderson. He stops when I bump into him, and, for a moment, Sam is the only thing holding me up.
That was awesome, Sam says. You were, like, glowing. Are you okay?
I draw myself up with some effort, not wanting to show any signs of weakness in front of Walker or Sanderson, even though I feel drained. Yeah, I'm good. I catch Walker staring at me with that same look of awe her driver had after I healed his neck. Sanderson, still sitting in front of me, looks close to tears. The black spider webs that crisscrossed beneath his skin have disappeared. His face no longer droops. His muscles aren't atrophied. He's still an old man, deep-set wrinkles lining his face, but he looks like a real old man, not one who slowly had the life drained out of him. He looks human.
Thank you,
Sanderson says to me, his words barely above a whisper. Nine looks at me, checking to see how I'm holding up, then turns to Sanderson and snorts derisively.
It's all for nothing, Grandpa, if you let those pasty-faced asshats land on Earth.
I'm ashamed of what I've done, what I became, Sanderson says, his gaze pleading and confused. But I don't understand what you expect me to do. Let them? How can I stop them?
We don't expect you to stop them, I say. Just slow them down. You need to rally people against them. When you make your speech tomorrow at the UN, you need to make it clear that the Mogadorian fleet can't be allowed to land on Earth. Sanderson stares at me, confused, then slowly swivels his gaze towards Walker.
Is that what your mole told you? Is that what you think will be happening tomorrow?
I know what's happening, Walker replies, no less caustic now that Sanderson seems to be coming around to our side. You and the other leaders who the Moogs have bought off will get up on stage and convince the world we should coexist peacefully.
Which is really just code for surrender, Nine adds.
Yes, that's planned for tomorrow, Sanderson says with a dark, hopeless laugh. But you've got the order confused. You think I give some speech and then their beloved leader lands his ships? You think he cares about the slow-turning wheels of human politics? He's not waiting for permission. The UN will convene to save lives, to calm a frightened population, because a military resistance is doomed against that.
Sanderson gestures wildly through the door, at the television still buzzing in the other room. Slowly we each turn, leaving Sanderson's bedroom for the penthouse living room, drawn in by the ashen face of a cable news anchor. She stumbles over her words as she tries to explain the unidentified flying objects manifesting in the air over dozens of major cities. The reception goes in and out, the bursts of static getting more and more frequent as something interferes with the signal.
Reports coming in that the ships have been sighted overseas as well, in places like London, Paris and Shanghai,
the newscaster says, eyes wide as she reads from a teleprompter.
If you're just joining us, something literally out of this world is happening. As ships of alien origin have appeared over Los Angeles, Washington.
It's happening, Sam says, stunned, looking at me for some kind of guidance. The warships are coming down. They're making their move. I don't know what to tell him. Grainy footage of a massive Mogadorian warship sliding out of the clouds in the sky over Los Angeles appears on screen. It's everything I dreaded coming to pass. The Mogadorian fleet is gliding slowly towards a woefully unprepared Earth. It's Lorien all over again.
I tried to tell you, Sanderson calls to us. It's already too late. They've already won. All that's left is surrender.
Chapter 22. I'm done doing what they tell me, what any of them tell me. My eyes snap open. I'd been in a deep sleep, one that I didn't think would be possible in my giant Mogadorian bed with its strange, slippery sheets. I'm becoming uncomfortably adjusted to life aboard the Anubis. I thought I heard a voice in my sleep, but maybe it was just my imagination, or the remnant of some dream. Not taking any chances, I stay very still and keep my breathing even, like I'm still asleep. If there is an intruder, I don't want them to know I'm awake. After a few seconds of silence, filled only by the ever-present hum of the warship's engines, a voice resumes speaking. One side drops us on this strange planet and basically forces us to fight for our lives. The other side, they talk about peace through progress, but that's all fancy talk for killing anyone who stands in their way. It's Five. He's in my room somewhere. I can't locate him in the near darkness. I can only hear his mumbled, under-the-breath rambling. I'm not even sure if he's talking to me. They all just wanted to use us, Five hisses, but I'm not going to let them. I'm not going to fight in their stupid war. He shifts then, and I can finally make out Five's outline. He's sitting on the edge of my bed, his skin the dark, slick texture of my sheets. He blends right into my covers, and it must be because he's touching them, using his externa. That means his legacies are back. It also means that he's seriously creeping me out, like a monster came crawling out from under my bed. I know you're awake, Five says to me without turning his head. The ship is descending. We aren't in orbit anymore. If you want to go, now is the time. I scoot up in bed, keeping the covers close. For a second, I consider making Five powerless again by charging the sheets with my Draenen. But what good would that do? I decide not to attack him. For now. I thought you were on their side, I say. Why would you help me? I'm not on anybody's side. I'm done with this whole thing. What do you mean, done? For a while, after my Saipan died, I was alone. It wasn't so bad. I'd like to go back to that, Five says. You know how many little islands there are in the oceans? I'm going to pick one out and stay there until this is over. I don't give a shit who wins, so long as they stay far away from me. That's cowardly, I reply, shaking my head. I'm not going to some deserted island with you. Five snorts. I didn't invite you, Ella. I'm getting off the ship, and I thought you might want to come along. That's as far as we go. I consider the possibility that this could be some kind of test, orchestrated by Cetricus Ra. But remembering the way Five acted earlier, I decide to take my chances that he's for real. I hop out of bed and pull on my thin-soled Mogadorian slippers.
Okay, what's your plan?
Five stands up, and his skin reverts to normal. As the automatic lights come on in my room, I can finally see his face. He's changed the bandage over his eye so that it isn't crusty with blood anymore, but he still hasn't gotten it healed. His remaining eye twinkles like he's excited to get into some trouble. Seeing him makes me second-guess my decision to join forces.
I'm going to open up one of the airlocks and jump out,
Five says, illustrating his brilliant plan.
That's nice for you. You can fly. What am I supposed to do?
Five reaches into his back pocket and casually tosses me a round object. I catch the stone in my hands and cradle it. I recognize it as one of the objects from John's chest.
Sithara stone,
Five explains.
I borrowed it from our friends.
You stole it, he shrugs.
I charged it with my flight legacy. Use it to fly off and save the planet.
I hide the stone inside my dress, then look up at Five.
So that's it? You think we're just going to walk off this ship?
Five raises an eyebrow at me. I notice that he's not wearing any shoes or socks, probably so his bare feet are in constant contact with the metal paneling of the Anubis. Also, attached to his forearm is some kind of contraption that looks like it might be a weapon.
They won't be able to stop me,
Five says, a dark confidence in his voice.
It isn't exactly inspiring, but it's the best hope I've got.
Okay, lead the way. The door to my room slides open for Five. He pokes his head out, checking to see that the coast is clear. When he's satisfied, Five hustles into the hallway, motioning for me to follow. We navigate the labyrinthine halls of the Anubis at a brisk walk.
Just act normal,
Five tells me, keeping his voice low.
He's got scouts watching us always, but they're also afraid of us. You, in particular, are supposed to be treated like royalty. They won't interfere if we don't look suspicious. And even if they do think something's wrong, by the time one of them actually works up the guts to tell beloved leader, we'll be gone.
He's talking a lot. That tells me that he's nervous. Without thinking about it, because if I actually thought about it, I might get too repulsed, I reach out and take Five's hand.
We're just a newly betrothed couple, getting to know each other, I say.
Enjoying a nice walk through the cozy halls of a massive warship. Five's hand is sweaty and cold. He tries to jerk away from me, his initial instinct not to be touched. But after a moment, he calms down and lets his dead fish hand be held.
Betrothed, he grunts. He wants us to get married?
That's what Cedric Azra said.
He says a lot of things.
Five's face is red, the blush traveling all the way up into his scalp. I'm not sure if he's embarrassed, or angry, or some combination of the two.
I didn't agree to that. You're a child.
Obviously I didn't agree either. You're a gross, murdering weirdo.
Shut up,
Five hisses, and for a second, I think that I've actually offended him. But then I realize we're passing by the open entranceway of the observation deck. I can't help but slow my steps as we sneak by. The empty darkness of space I'd gotten used to has been replaced by the familiar, bright blue atmosphere of Earth. The Anubis is still making its descent. But already, the outline of civilization is visible. Roads boxing up green fields, tiny houses arranged into perfect suburbs. Dozens of Mogadorians have gathered to watch Earth approach, an excited energy in the air as they whisper to one another, probably talking about which swath of land they'll pillage first.
Five leads me around the next corner and crashes right into two Moog warriors who are jogging towards the observation deck. The nearest one lifts a corner of his mouth in a disdainful sneer, eyeing us.
"What are you two doing?"
the Moog asks. In response, I draw myself up, trying to look as regal as possible. I fix the overcurious Moog with a cold stare. The Moog's sneer quickly fades as he remembers himself, or more likely, remembers that I'm not just some Lorian, but the blood of his beloved leader, and he looks down at the floor. He begins to mutter something apologetic when a metallic shink cuts him off. A needle-like blade extends from the leather contraption on Five's forearm. In a blur, Five drives the blade right through the first Moog's forehead, instantly turning him to ash. The other Moog's eyes widen in panic, and he tries to run. A delighted grin spreads across Five's face. Before the Moog can get even a few steps down the hall, Five's non-blade arm takes on a rubbery consistency and stretches after him. Five's arm snakes around the Moog's neck and then yanks him backwards so Five can finish him off with his blade. The whole thing is over in about 10 seconds. "We were supposed to be acting normal," I say to Five in a loud whisper, mindful that we're not all that far from the crowded observation room. Five blinks at me, almost like he's not sure what just came over him. Carefully, he presses the blade back into its holster.
"I lost my cool, okay?"
Five anxiously rubs his hand across the stubble on top of his head.
"It doesn't matter now. We're almost there."
I stare at this unhinged monster standing in front of me. He gulps down a few deep breaths, his shoulders shaking, fists balled from the excitement. Minutes ago, he sounded almost fragile, rambling in the darkness of my room. He's broken, a total mess. I have to remind myself that he murdered 8 in order to squelch the swelling of sympathy I feel for him. Sympathy, yes, but also fear. He flew off the handle with zero provocation and almost seemed happy killing those Moogs. This screwed-up, violent, cowardly traitor is my only real hope of getting off the Anubis. I shake my head. "Let's go," I sigh. Five nods, and we jog on, tossing out the whole hand-holding thing and just careening towards our destination. As we run, I notice Five clenching and unclenching his hands. They're both empty. "How'd you do that with your arm?" I ask him, thinking about those rubber and steel balls he used to change his skin in the lecture hall. "I thought you needed to be touching something." Five turns his head so his good eye is on me. He touches the fresh bandage over his face.
"Losing an eye gave me some new, storage possibilities," he says.
"Ugh," I reply, grossed out as I picture the rubber ball shoved into Five's eye socket. "How'd you lose it anyway?"
"Marina,"
he answers simply, no malice in his voice.
"I had it coming."
"I'm sure." We round the next corner and the hallway opens up, the ceiling rising as we enter the huge docking bay. I can see crisp blue sky through the portholes, sunlight pouring across the dozens of docked Mogadorian scout vessels. Other than the ships, the docking bay is empty. The mechanics and crew must be on the observatory deck, gazing out upon the world they plan to conquer. "We're so close."
"Hold on," I say. "If we open the airlock, are we going to be sucked out right away?"
"We're in the atmosphere now, not space,"
Five says impatiently. He leans over a nearby console, studying the interface.
"It'll be windy. You're not going to chicken out, are you?"
"No," I say, looking around the docking bay.
Do you think we could blow some of this stuff up? Maybe bring down the Anubis before it has a chance to do anything? Five turns to me, looking slightly impressed.
You have any explosive legacies?
No.
Me neither. Know how to make a bomb?
No.
Then we're going to have to settle for escaping,
Five says. Five hits a button on the console, and a thick metal door thuds into place behind us. It's the airlock, sturdy enough to keep the ship safe from the vacuum of space. It effectively seals us off from the rest of the ship.
That'll slow them down,
Five says, referring to the pursuers we don't yet have. Good thinking, I admit, as I peer through the small window on the airlock, expecting to see Moogs chasing us down at any moment. Five taps out a few more keystrokes, and with a hydraulic whine and a gust of chilled air, the docking bay doors at the far end of the room open up. The wind pulls at me and I let out a deep, relieved sigh. I reach into my dress and remove the Sithara stone, clutching it. Slowly, I walk towards the open dock, wondering what it'll be like to pitch myself into that open blue sky. Way better than life on the Anubis, that's for sure. So, I just hold this stone and fly? I ask, looking over my shoulder at Five.
Supposed to be how it works,
he answers.
Just imagine your body light as a feather, floating on air. That's how I learned to use my legacy anyway.
I glance towards the open air, the cloudless sky waiting for me. What if it doesn't work? Five starts towards me, sighing.
Come on, we'll go together.
You won't be going anywhere.
Cetricus Ross steps out from between two of the ships. I'm not sure if he's been there the whole time, waiting for us, or if he's just teleported into the room somehow. Either way, it doesn't matter. We're caught. Still in his human form, Cetricus Ross stands between us and the open docking bay, the wind gently blowing through his perfect brown hair, plucking at the lapels of his suit. He holds his golden staff, the Eye of Thalok, in one hand. Five puts a hand on my shoulder and tries to push me behind him. I shake him off. We face Cetricus Ross side by side.
Get out of our way, old man,
Five growls. He's trying to sound tough, but he can barely manage to meet Cetricus Ra's eyes.
I will not,
Cetricus Ra replies, his voice full of scorn and disappointment.
I expected this kind of behavior from you, Ella. You have only recently joined us, and it will take time to undo the brainwashing you endured at the hands of the guard. But Five, my boy, after everything I have done for you.
Shut up,
Five says quietly, almost pleading.
You talk and talk, but none of it's true.
Mine is the only truth,
Cetricus Ra counters sternly.
You will be punished for your insolence.
Five still can't bring himself to look directly at Cetricus Ra, but his shoulders rise up and down rapidly, just like in the hallway with the Moog warriors. Inside his chest, a low rumble starts to build. It reminds me of a tea kettle coming to a boil. I take a subtle step to the side, worried that Five might literally explode.
Enough of this inanity, children, Cetricus Ra says.
But his latest rebuke is partially drowned out by the rabid scream that tears loose from Five's lungs. And then he charges. At first, Five's bare feet make slapping sounds across the metal deck. But as he nears Cetricus Ra, his footfalls become metal clanging against metal, his externa changing his skin to match the floor. Cetricus Ra merely raises an eyebrow at Five, not impressed or intimidated in the least. I don't just stand around and watch. While Five charges in, I make a break for one of the nearby tool carts. If I can grab a wrench or any other object to charge with my Draenen, maybe I can recreate yesterday's lesson. Only this time, my target will be Cetricus Raw. That plan, along with whatever Five intended to do, gets scrapped when Cetricus Raw sweeps his arm from side to side. A wave of telekinetic force blasts across us, knocking me completely off my feet and scattering the nearby tools to the far wall. His telekinesis is so powerful that some of the ships even rock to the side, their shocks grinding and creaking. I land hard on my stomach and immediately roll over to reorient myself. Five was knocked into the air too, but caught himself with his flight legacy. He floats just a few yards from Cetricus Raw. Five's skin is no longer the dull gray of the docking bay floor. It has changed into a glistening chrome, like the ball bearing I know he carries around. So that must be jammed into his eye socket as well.
"Stop at once,"
Cetricus Raw warns, but Five is way past the point of listening. Five soars in towards Cetricus Raw, throwing big, looping punches with the intention of smashing his pretty human face. Cetricus Raw deflects the blows easily with his cane, although Five's sheer animalistic fury is enough to drive Cetricus Raw back towards the open docking bay doors. Their scuffle opens up a path for me. Let these two crazies duke it out. All I have to do is make a break for it, dive into the open blue sky, and hope the Satharis stone does what Five said. Just when I start to make my move, I notice Cetricus Raw's eyes flash. I feel an invisible field of energy pass over me, almost like the pressure in the room has changed. As he's in the middle of throwing a punch, Five's skin turns back to normal. His fist crunches against Cetricus Raw's upraised cane. At the same moment, Five falls out of the air with a shout. It's just like at Dulcie Base. Cetricus Raw has created some kind of field that cancels legacies. He's an Eternus like me, and now I know that Cetricus Raw and I also share Draenen. His technique is different from anything I've been able to learn. It's like he's charged the molecules in the air around him, creating a radius where legacies are useless. Except it doesn't work on me. I can still feel my Draenen lurking within me, and I know that I could use my Eternus if I wanted. Somehow, I'm immune to Cetricus Raw's version of Draenen. Is it because we're related? Or is one of my legacies an immunity to Cetricus Raw? He said all that crap about our legacies coming randomly and Lorien being nothing but chaos. But what if he's wrong and my legacies have been specifically chosen to destroy him? More important, does Cetricus Raw know that his power doesn't affect me? In that moment, Cetricus Raw isn't paying me any attention at all. He's completely focused on Five. I know I should make a break for it, but I find myself rooted in place. Even after everything he's done, can I really leave Five behind? Five is on his knees in front of Cetricus Raw, clutching his injured hand to his belly. Cetricus Raw's unimposing human form has grown by a few feet. He's taller and broader now, inflated in a way that is vaguely grotesque. He reaches down and palms Five's head into one unnaturally large hand.
"All you needed to do was follow orders,"
Cetricus Raw seethes at Five. He jerks Five's head back so he can look him in the face.
"We could have walked into the sanctuary together if you'd only brought me that damned pendant. And now, this. You dare raise a hand against your beloved leader. You disgust me, boy."
I don't know what Cetricus Raw means by sanctuary, but I make a mental note of it. I also take a step towards him and Five, still torn between fleeing and helping, and uncertain of what I could even do in a fight against the Mogadorian ruler. Five's head is cocked at an awkward angle, so he can only gurgle in response to Cetrica's Ra's ranting.
I should have known that no member of the guard could truly be salvaged,
Cetrica's Ra continues.
You are my greatest failure, Five, but you will be my last.
Five cries out as Ra's hand tightens on his skull. My stomach turns over as I realize he's literally going to crush Five's head. I can't let that happen. With all the telekinetic force I can muster, I shove Cetricus Ra towards the open docking bay doors. His eyes widen in surprise as he stumbles backwards, the open air tugging at his fancy suit, which is now bulging at the seams from his inhuman growth spurt. Cetricus Ra loses his grip on Five's head, his nails scratching divots into his scalp. He manages to stop himself before I push him off the Anubis, and I can feel his telekinesis battle back against mine.
Ella, how?
He starts to ask, surprise mixing with frustration. But then Five is charging at him, his forearm blade extended.
Die!
Five bellows. Cetricus Ra tries to step aside, but can't entirely avoid Five. The blade plunges into his shoulder. I scream as a piercing jolt of pain courses through me. A hole in my shoulder opens up, warm blood pouring down my front. I stagger against one of the nearby ships, clutching the wound, trying to stop the bleeding with my fingers. Five recoils from Cetricus Ra, his eyes wide. The Mogadorian looks unharmed. Cetricus Ra smiles as Five turns to gape at me. I'm run through right where he should have stabbed Cetricus Ra.
Now look what you did,
Cetricus Ra chides. The Mogadorian charm, I realize, even as I start to feel faint. Any damage done to Cetricus Ra is instead done to me. Five looks horrified by what he's done. Before he can react, Cetricus Ra picks him up by the throat and slams the back of his head violently against the hull of the nearest ship. He does this again and again until Five's body is limp. Then, callously, Cetricus Ra tosses his unconscious body out the open doors of the Anubis. I try to reach Five with my telekinesis, but I'm too weak. His body plummets out of sight, towards the earth below. I collapse to the floor, blood seeping through my fingers. All the strength has gone out of me. I won't be escaping from the Anubis today. My grandfather has won. Cetricus Ra stands over me, his human form returned to normal, although his suit is ruined. He shakes his head, his smile like a disappointed teacher.
Come now, Ella, he says. We must put this episode behind us.
I hold up my blood-covered hand for him to see. Why? Why did you do this to me?
It was the only way for you to learn that Mogadorian progress is more important than even your own life,
he replies. Cetricus Ra gathers me up in his arms. As I start to lose consciousness, he whispers gently,
You won't disobey beloved leader again, will you?
Chapter 23 Adam's flight plan is to take us down the Atlantic coast until we hit Florida, then dip back west over the Gulf, and finally arrive at the southeastern tip of Mexico. With the skimmer flying at maximum speed and staying low enough to avoid any other aircraft, the trip should take about 4 hours. It's a quiet ride. I lean back in my seat and watch the coast ebb and flow beneath us. Adam doesn't say much of anything. He keeps his eyes straight ahead, occasionally adjusting our course when his systems pick up another aircraft. Dust naps on the floor at his feet. As for Marina, she remains typically rigid, her whole fear of flying thing not getting any better with a Mogadorian at the controls. "You know, you can rest for a few hours," Adam suggests eventually, his tone cautious. I'd already been close to dozing off, so he must be talking to Marina. She's sitting straight-backed, a slight chill coming off her. She must be looming right in the corner of Adam's eye. Marina seems to consider this for a moment, then leans forward so that her head is nearly on Adam's shoulder. He raises an eyebrow, but otherwise keeps his hands on the controls.
"The last trip Six and I made south was less than a week ago," Marina says, her voice measured. "We found out too late that we had a traitor traveling with us. I ended up stabbing him in the eye. That was me being merciful."
"I know what happened in Florida," Adam says. "Why are you telling me this?"
"Because I want you to know what will happen if you betray us," Marina replies, leaning back. "And don't tell me to rest."
Adam looks over at me for help, but I shrug my shoulders and turn away. Marina's still figuring out just how angry she wants to be, and I'm not going to get in her way. Besides, I don't think putting a little fear in our Mogadorian companion is such a bad thing. I assume he's just going to let the conversation die. But after a few minutes, Adam speaks up. "Yesterday, for the first time, I picked up a sword that's been in my family for generations. I'd never been allowed to touch it before, only admire it from afar. It belonged to my father, General Andrakus Sutek. He was fighting number 4, John. I drove that sword through my father's back and killed him." Adam delivers this speech matter-of-factly, like he's reading the news. I blink at him, then glance over my shoulder at Marina. She's looking down at the floor, deep in thought. As the chill rising off her begins to die down, Dust picks himself up and goes over to her. The wolf rests his head in Marina's lap. "Cool story," I say to Adam when it becomes painfully clear that someone needs to break the silence. "I've never known anyone who carried around a sword before." "Cool," Adam repeats, frowning. "My point is, you don't need to doubt my loyalty."
"I'm sorry you had to do that to your father," Marina says after a moment. "I didn't know."
"I'm not," Adam replies brusquely. "But thanks for the sympathy." To break the tension, I start messing with some of the dials on the skimmer's console. "Does this thing have a freaking radio or what? Are we just going to tell death stories the whole way?" Adam is quick to readjust the dials right after me. I think I catch him smiling a little, probably relieved that the death threat portion of the trip is over. "There's no radio," he says. "I can hum some Mogadorian standards if you'd like." "Oh, barf," I reply, and Marina snickers in the back seat. I realize Adam is giving me a funny look, his angular face more open than I've seen, that defensive stoicism he wears stripped away. For a moment, he almost looks comfortable being up here with two of his mortal enemies. "What?" I ask, and he hurriedly looks away. I realize his mind was elsewhere. "Nothing," he says, almost wistful. "For a second there, you just reminded me of someone I used to know." The rest of the flight is uneventful. I managed to doze off once or twice, although never for long. With Dust snuggled up against her, it seems like Marina is finally able to relax. Adam refrains from humming any Mogadorian anthems. We're flying over the tropical forest of Campeche, Mexico, just another hour away from the Lorik sanctuary supposedly hidden amid the ruins of an ancient Mayan city, when a red warning light begins to flash on the skimmer's translucent windshield. I only notice it when Adam tenses up. "Damn it," he says, and immediately starts flicking switches on the skimmer's control panel. What is it? Someone's locked onto us. The cameras mounted on the skimmer send images to our screen, views from the underside of the ship and behind us becoming visible. I don't see anything but cloudless blue sky and the dense canopy of the forest beneath us. Where are they coming from? Marina asks, squinting as she peers through the window. There, Adam says, jabbing his finger at the screen. On it, a Mogadorian scout ship just like ours drifts slowly towards us from below. Its roof is painted in overlapping shades of greens, camouflage to match the forest it detached from. Can we outrun it? Marina asks. I can try, Adam replies, pulling down the lever to give our skimmer some more juice. Or we can just shoot it down, I suggest. As we pick up a little speed, the blinking red light on the console multiplies into 4 blinking red lights. There are more of them. 2 identical skimmers rise up from the jungle right in front of us, another along our side. The first still sits right on our tail. Hemmed in, Adam has no choice but to stop. The other skimmers surround us. They all have guns too, right? Marina asks. Yes, Adam replies. We're at a distinct disadvantage. Not quite, I say, and focus on the sky outside. What was cloudless a moment ago slowly begins to darken, clouds rolling in at my beckoning. Hold on, Adam warns. We don't want to give away you're all on board. You're sure they won't shoot us down? 90%, Adam says. I let go of the storm I was whipping up, allowing the clouds to drift through the sky along their natural course. A second later, a shrill beep emanates from our dashboard. They're hailing us, Adam says. They want to talk. Another plan has occurred to me, one that doesn't involve fighting a mid-air battle against bad odds. You said you're some general's kid, right? I say to Adam. So can't you, like, throw your weight around or something? As Adam considers this, the dashboard communicator bleats again. I should tell you, I'm not exactly well-liked among my people, he says. They might not listen to me. Yeah, well, that's a risk, I admit. Worst-case scenario, they take you prisoner, right? Adam grimaces. Yeah. So, we let them take us where we're going. Don't worry. We'll rescue you. You need to do something, Marina says, waving towards the windshield. The ship directly in front of us, getting impatient or suspicious, has brought its blaster turret around to aim at us. All right, go invisible, Adam says. I reach around my seat and grasp Marina's hand, disappearing the both of us. Sensing the situation, dust shrinks down into a tiny gray mouse and skitters under Adam's seat. Adam hits a button on the console, and a video feed crackles to life on our screen. A nasty-looking Mogadorian scout, his empty eyes too close together, his teeth short and sharp, stares at Adam with a look of fierce annoyance. He barks something in harsh Mogadorian. Immersion protocol dictates we speak English while on Earth, you vat-born cretin. Adam replies coldly. He draws himself up in his chair, suddenly so regal that I kinda want to slap him. You are addressing Adamus Sutek, trueborn son of General Andrakus Sutek. I am on urgent business from my father. Lead me to the Lorik site immediately. I have to give it to Adam. He's an excellent bullshitter. The scout's expression goes from annoyance to confusion, and finally to outright fear. Yes, sir, right away, the scout replies, and in response, Adam immediately cuts off the conversation. One by one, the skimmers break up the ring they had us trapped inside and let us get back on course. That worked, Marina says, sounding a little stunned as she lets go of my hand. For now, Adam replies, frowning uncertainly. He was low-ranking, Whoever's in command will be a different story. Can't you just tell them your dad sent you down here to check their progress? I ask. Assuming they don't know I betrayed our people and that my father essentially sentenced me to die? Yeah, that might work. You only need to distract them for a little bit, I say. Long enough for Marina and me to figure a way into the sanctuary.
There it is, Marina says, watching through the windows as the skimmers begin to descend towards Kalak Mool.
There are a bunch of ancient little buildings below, all of them constructed from limestone that's been eroding for centuries, the jungle creeping in to reclaim them. My eyes are drawn to the huge pyramid-shaped temple that towers over them all. Built on a low hill, the temple is blocky, covered in steep and crumbling staircases that are chiseled right into the stone. I can't quite make it out from this distance, but there appears to be some kind of door at the top of the pyramid. How much you want to bet we need to climb up to that thing, I say.
It's the sanctuary, Marina replies. I'm certain of it.
So are my people, obviously, Adam says. The Mogadorians have cleared the jungle around the sanctuary in a perfect ring, the trees all chopped down, an entire fleet of Mogadorian scout ships parked on the naked soil. Besides the dozens of skimmers, I can make out an array of tents where the Mogs must be camping. There's also what looks to be a couple of heavy-duty missile launchers and blaster turrets, all of these weapons aimed at the temple. And yet the structure looks completely untouched. Oddly, at the base of the temple and creeping up the sides, there are still overgrown trees and vines, untended for years. It's a stark contrast to the severe neatness of the Mogadorian perimeter, where everything natural has been cleared away.
It's like something kept them from getting too close, Marina says, noticing the same thing as me.
Malcolm did say that only the guard could enter, I reply. Our escort of Moog ships float down to the makeshift airfield, and Adam lands a few yards away from them. The sanctuary looms in the distance. The only thing standing between us and the Lorik Temple is a strip of wide-open land and a small army of Mogadorians, many of whom have begun gathering in the airfield, all of them armed with blasters. Some welcoming committee, I say, glancing at Adam. He watches his people mass on the monitor, swallows hard, and unbuckles himself from the pilot seat. All right, I'll go first. Lead them away somehow. You guys get into the sanctuary.
I don't like this, Marina says. There's a lot of them.
It'll be fine, Adam says. Just get inside and do what you have to do. With that, Adam opens the cockpit and hops onto the skimmer's hull. There are about 30 Mogadorians down below, waiting on him, with more walking over from the tents. Marina and I hunker down inside the skimmer, my hand close to hers in case we need to go invisible. Who's in charge here? Adam yells, standing tall and rigid, again putting on his true-born airs. A tall female warrior, dressed in a sleeveless black overcoat, steps forward. She has two thick braids that start on the sides of her head and wrap around it, encircling the traditional Mogadorian tattoos on her scalp. Her hands are wrapped in dusty white bandages, like they've recently been injured or burned. I am Firi Dunra, true-born daughter of the Honorable Magoth Dunra, the warrior shouts to Adam. Her posture is nearly as imposing and rigid as his. Why have you come here, Sutek? Adam hops down from our ship, tossing his head to flip his hair out of his eyes. Orders from beloved leader himself. I am to inspect this site to prepare for his arrival. A tremor passes through the crowd when Adam mentions Cetricus Ra. Many of the Mogs exchange nervous glances. Firi Dunra, however, appears nonplussed. She strides forward, letting her blaster dangle idly next to her hip. Something tightens up in my stomach at the sight of her. The predatory way she moves, the glint in her eye like trouble could spark at any moment. She's way sharper than the other Moog warriors I've encountered. "Ah, beloved leader! Of course," Fury says. She waves to the temple in the distance. "What would you like to see first, sir?" Adam takes a step towards the Moog camp and opens his mouth to speak. Smoothly, without warning, Fury lifts her blaster and cracks Adam across the mouth with the handle. As he falls to the ground, the rest of the Mogadorians level their blasters at him in unison. "How about the inside of a cell, traitor?" Fury snarls, standing over Adam, her blaster pointed at his face. Chapter 24. I extend my hand to Marina, and she grasps it immediately. Invisible, we carefully climb out of the ship, synchronizing our movements. Behind us, I hear a sudden flapping of wings. Dust takes flight in the shape of a tropical bird, his wings flecked with gray. None of the Moogs notice him soar out of the cockpit, and they don't hear Marina and me leap down to the ground. They're too distracted by the show Fury Dunra is putting on with Adam. "I know your father, Sutek," Fury is saying, projecting her voice so that the Moogs gathered in a semicircle around her and Adam can all hear. "He's a bastard, but at least he's noble. He believes in Mogadorian progress." If Adam manages a reply, I can't hear it over the murmur of agreement that comes from the other Moogs. I catch a glimpse of him through the crowd. He's crumpled at Fury's feet, scrabbling in the dirt, trying to regain his feet, but probably still seeing stars. "In fact, your father gave me this assignment," Fury continues. "I was responsible for a team that allowed a guard to escape from the West Virginia stronghold. The punishment was either death or a journey here. Not much of a choice, really. You see, if we fail, we'll all be executed anyway. The only way to live is for us to deliver the sanctuary." At the word sanctuary, Fury makes a sarcastically dramatic gesture with her two bandaged hands that encompasses the whole of the temple. I hesitate for a moment to listen to what else she has to say. There's not a day goes by that I don't wonder if I made the wrong decision. Maybe a quick death would have been better. "You see, Sutek, all of us were sent here as punishment," Fury explains. It occurs to me that she's not just talking to Adam. She's also trying to fire up her troops. Maybe morale gets low in the jungle. "We were sent to this forsaken place to bring down the impenetrable shield that surrounds whatever spoils the Lorik have hidden within. For all of us, it is our last chance to impress beloved leader. It's the perfect place for a traitor like you." Fury crouches down in front of Adam. "So, do you know the secret to the sanctuary? Have you come here to redeem yourself at last?"
"Yeah," comes Adam's groggy reply. "If it's a force field, try throwing yourself at it."
Fury actually laughs at Adam's quip. It's that laugh that gets me moving again. It has an air of menace to it, like her little sideshow is about to wrap up. That means we have to hurry. I tug Marina, and we slip behind the gathered Mogadorians. Adam's created one hell of a diversion. If we were sticking to the plan, we could make it inside the perimeter of the sanctuary easily. But I'm not willing to leave Adam to his fate, and I don't think Marina is either. Instead of heading for the temple, we move swiftly towards one of the mounted blaster turrets that the Moogs have been using to fruitlessly fire at whatever force protects the sanctuary.
"Throw myself at it," Fury is repeating, her laughter dying down. That isn't such a bad idea, Sutek. Why don't you